It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. I say that every week. I want to repeat the last part today. I'm glad you're here. I said that line, I'm glad you're here, when we started making the show. And the first time, it was almost spontaneously. Just felt like an extra sentence was needed for the rhythm of the whole thing. It's Depression Mode. Da-da-da-da-da-da. And so that one just showed up. But I've learned to trust instincts like that. Once I said it out loud, I knew it meant a lot of different things. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're listening to this particular show here on Maximum Fun. I had another mental health podcast before. I'm glad you made the journey over to the new one. I'm glad you're here because with you here and more people coming to join you and me, we can make something together that can help folks and be sustainable. We're in our annual Max Fun Drive right now, by the way. More about that later in the show. I'm glad you're here also means that I'm glad you're alive and able to be here. Not everyone is. Depression and other mental disorders can be fatal. I mourn the people we have lost. I vow to fight on for the people who are here. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're here because with the pronouns in that sentence, I and you, we make it us. We're together. And that's good. The world is rough sometimes. And if you have interesting minds, like many of us do, it can be very difficult and confusing. In a world that sometimes gives us the fight of our lives when we're just trying to go about our day, we are we. We are together. It is the value proposition of Depression Mode, of all the work that I do, that if people can connect and hear about each other's mental health journeys, it will help. We will recognize ourselves in the words of others, and a greater we can be formed, and we shall all be healed. Maybe not cured, but healed. And we can enjoy beautiful things together, like music and laughs. One of the voices that speaks most directly to my soul is John Darnielle. John is the lead singer, songwriter, main guy in The Mountain Goats. He's been making music as The Mountain Goats for over 25 years. In the early years, The Mountain Goats was usually just John. He'd take the stage for shows and say, "Hello, we're The Mountain Goats," and it was just him up there. John's a huge fan of death metal music, doesn't make it, but loves it. John has been many things in life. He's been a child in an abusive home, a teenager living on the streets and doing a lot of drugs. He's been a nurse in a psychiatric ward. He has a degree in English. He's dealt with depression and especially severe anxiety. John Darnielle's songs speak to a broad range of human emotion and experience. Often the songs are about his own life, sometimes characters he creates. Sometimes they're about God. And a lot of times, more than you might expect, they're about professional wrestling. For me, John Darnielle's music is about what it means to be a person and everything that is painful and beautiful and exciting and interesting and dark and bright in that experience. I can listen and feel understood, which just helps. And that's also why I make Depression Mode, why all of us who work on the show make the show you're listening to. You're not alone. You're with us. I'm glad you're here. In this interview, which I am about to play, John and I talk about his anxiety, his substance use, his weird TikTok fame. We talk about John Hodgman. We talk about youth in distress. But we start out talking about violence. See, John doesn't just write songs, he writes novels, critically acclaimed, popular novels. And his latest is called Devil House. It's about crime and violence and murder in a California town. The main character, Gage Chandler, is a true crime author. John Darnielle sort of wrote a crime book, but also wrote a book about writing a crime book. So how would John Darnielle describe Devil House?
A very emotional crime novel, I would say, you know. I mean, the thing is, like, some of my favorite writers, Sicilian mystery writer named Sciascia, S-C-I-A-S-C-I-A, I mean, he's just writing mysteries, really, but they're really, really good. And so the distinction between pop literature and literature is bogus anyway. But yeah, it's like, so it's in a sense, I'm writing, you know, a sort of a literary crime fiction.
Okay.
In this book. Yeah.
It occurs to me now, this is crime fiction, but the true crime genre is so huge right now in the last few years in books and especially in podcasting. Why do you think that is? Why have people gravitated to that?
Well, I have some ideas that I'm happy to share, but I just want to say that I'm glad it happened over the past 2 years because I started writing this book about 5 years ago. And then fortuitously, people got really interested in its theme while I was going. You know, so that was very nice for me.
I timed the opening of mental health awareness in the same way. Like I got up 2 years
good.
Ago.
The universe just comes up to meet you. It's nice. So the thing is, true crime is having this moment, right? And when something is having a moment, it usually, I think, comes after everybody has sort of realized that that's something they're into. It's like it takes a while to crest, you know. And this has been brewing. I mean, it's been true forever. If you look at the Grand Guignol theater of France in the late 19th century, there was this theater that sort of is like one of the original inspirations for the splatter movies, right? Of the, well, for the Gialli, the Italian antecedents of the splatter movies, was this theater that just had buckets of blood on stage. Every play ended with everybody dying, you know, and it was very controversial. The authorities, you know, people writing hand-wringing pieces about will a Grand Guignol bring down Paris or Parisian culture or so forth. And they were doing revivals of, like, Roman tragedies, which are much bloodier than the Greek ones. All the blood would, like, be on stage. You know, maybe. We don't know how they were staged. But true crime, I think, is in that legacy of people want to read about stuff. People have a hunger for violence that's pretty essential, right? Pretty, you know, we're bloody-minded people. And people throughout history have various ways of satisfying that. At our worst of times, we just attend public executions, right? Now that's, you don't like to think about knowing somebody who would actually, even if it's an evil villain, taking actual pleasure in watching somebody die. That's, we try not to be that way now. We hope we've evolved a little in some way, morally, you know, even if it's somebody who did something terrible, you don't want to be the person cheering on the executioner, right? You hope you don't, but I think we still have the itch, you know, the itch is there. And I think in true crime, especially the way it's presented a lot now, there's this sort of moralism, I have it both ways, moralism where, you know, there's the claim that you're presenting it sort of as a cautionary tale and as a way of identifying villains and telling more heroic stories and so forth. But there's a very pornographic element to it. Now, I don't say this from a standpoint of moral purity. I'm the same as anybody else. The amount of true crime I've gone through is pretty intense. Although after I became a dad, my stomach for it really dropped. My stomach to actually be able to hear about true stories of horrors inflicted on people's families. I don't come from the healthiest of families, right? But now I have one. Now I think I have a better sense of, like, when something comes along that devastates a family, what got broken there, you know? And so it sort of changed, it thickened, you know, it complicated the way I think about it. But I'm always, when I talk about this book, I'm always wanting to be very clear. It's not a book that says, and therefore true crime is bad, because I think that would be infantile. You know, it's right. Like that's not, anything like that is not, that's how simple-minded people think. And I try not to be too simple-minded.
Well, and it's reductive too. I mean, there's a lot of gruesome things and a lot of violent things that happen in the book. I mean, do you think it's a matter of people needing to find ways to cope with that instinct, that kind of bloodthirsty porn for violence thing that they have?
Well, yeah, we talk about this in death metal too. And with death metal, it usually, like, that's the way the guys who make it talk about it. It's like they, you know, so many of us have some sort of trauma, you know, some sort of unresolved issues. It's those of us who don't have any unresolved issues. I haven't met any of them, you know, I'm sure they're out there somewhere, but
they're not listening to this show, don't
but
worry.
But I've talked to death metal people who, I talked to Eric Rutan, you know, who talked some about struggles he faced in his adolescence and how when he found death metal, Eric Rutan, he's from Morbid Angel and Ripping Corpse and Hate Eternal is his main thing, fantastic dude. And about how that music, you know, was a place for him to explore, you know, not just express a simple anger, but to explore the vast terrain of the anger that he had, you know. And that's the thing is, like, you know, when we say, oh, it's getting your aggressions out. Well, your aggressions are rich and complex. They're not just a simple, I want to punch somebody. They're rooted in so many things. And so you make this complex, very technically adept music that sort of explores that space in a safe place. And that's, you know, and that's what therapy is. You go to therapy, right? And you say whatever you want to, and the therapist doesn't judge you, right? and then you're able to let stuff out in a safe environment, right? That's how therapy works, right? And that's how music works also, is you can art of any sort, you can work out this stuff in the safe environment of the art and nobody gets hurt, right? What Gage Chandler is pointing out is, well, he writes true crime books, so that has real people in them. And once you put a real person in your story, it's a different story, right? Because it's not just your story. And this is true also if you're telling fiction, if you're describing people who have lived lives that you're not familiar with. Some of those issues are in here too, right? If you're trying to write about Appalachia and you have not spent time in Appalachia, I gotta ask you, you know, oughtn't the people there have some say? Shouldn't you at the very least, you know, like bare minimum, go visit with some of these people, you know? But I think also that we see that again and again. I spent 2 weeks in Appalachia and then I wrote an authoritative book about it. Well, I don't know. So, you know, so some of that is, I think what I'm writing about in this book is standing, who has standing to speak, right? And I'm writing about a writer who comes to face this question about whether he has standing to talk about lives in a way that frames them forever for other people.
It strikes me that, okay, so you're writing about some of these things, that, and you're writing fiction, but you're writing about someone encountering violence and then trying to find a way to write about it, trying to find a way to frame it, contextualize it, make it a story, give it an arc and not just some events that happen. And then we also brushed up on the idea of the occult and Satan and horror. And I'm struck by the idea of getting these things out. I think I'm stuck on the word out because so much of it seems like you're not expelling it from your person. You're finding a way to manage it. You're trying to find a way to tame that dog, right?
Well, to surface it, I mean, this is a super classic liberal notion, right? But that once you bring things to the surface, then you can make them productive. And then if they're not, if you fail to surface them, they're going to do stuff anyway, right? We know this with emotions, right? That if you have, I mean, William Blake knew this. This is not a 20th century thing. I was angry with my friend. I told my friend my wrath did end, right? I was angry with my foe. I told it not. My wrath did grow, right? And that's how feelings work. If you don't find some way to surface them constructively, they fester and they do something inside you because they have to do something, right? And I mean, I think that's true with, you know, it's probably true in other areas where it's not quite as important to us personally, individually, you know, like you can be secretly interested in, I don't know, classifications of dates, you know, I mean, I'm talking here about our medjool dates, but there's also Rutab dates, you know, there's many other types. And you could get really into them, as I have lately, or you could just be vaguely interested every time you pass them on the shelf, but there's no stake in that. But when I'm writing, I have all these low-level thoughts that are like, you know, I'm not a philosopher, I'm not going to write op-ed pieces, I'm more interested in seeing what images and ideas do when you just let them loose a little bit. And it is sort of like, you know, going out to the, you know, if I had a backyard farm, you know, the style with some animals, you open up, let the animals roam around, see what they bring back, you know.
Mm-hmm. Were you always interested in the fiction or even true crime about violence, and interested in Satan and the occult and bloody sacrifices? How far back does that go with you?
So it's super, I have a story and I'll never know what became of my little friend Elaine, who I played with when I was 7. Uh-huh. But she was a year older than I was. She was 8. So like 8 and 7, you know, that's a pretty, she was bigger than me and older than me and smarter. She was bookish and I like to hang out with bookish people. And I asked some question about some movie or book that I was interested in. She said, oh no, I don't like it. It's violent. And I had a big crush on Elaine. And I was like, oh, then I don't like it either. That's sort of in my nature. And so, but the thing that's funny about me is like, this was a summer, we hung out for a month or two in the summer and that was the end of that. I moved somewhere else, you know. However, I carried the position that I had adopted because I wanted to agree with Elaine for at least another 6 years. that's what I'm like, really. It's like, this tells you a lot about me. Is it like if you tell me something and I like you, and so I decide I agree with you, it'll be a good long time before I interrogate that position. Right? And for me,
it's going on the hard drive at that point.
Yeah, no, it really, I don't know if this is still true of me, but I have to assume it is. But it was for the longest time that if somebody said, oh, this sucks, you know, I'd be like 10, you know, and I hear that disco sucks from all my rock people, then I stop listening to dance music for like 3 or 4 years because, hey, that's not what we listen. And, you know, very like a sponge in some ways, you know, for the longest time when I was young. But with Violence, I had adopted this sort of ad hoc position because I liked Elaine and looked up to her, you know, and then in my adolescence, for reasons that are kind of obvious, I'm sort of having to confront the question of Violence at a more direct level, and I decided that I liked to see it represented for the very reasons I was talking about with death metal. It's like, it's in a controllable space. It's imaginary. Nobody's actually getting hurt. And yet, the thrill of it, and this is like a secret if you've lived through Violence, is like, there is an excitement. There is a charge to the environment in which Violence takes place. It's an unpleasant charge. It's not fun. Right? And it's traumatic and scarring, but there's also a charge to the air. This happens to soldiers. They go to war. Well, war is terrible, right? But you come home and everything seems a little two-dimensional compared to when it's life or death out there, you know? And it's the same way if you come from a place where maybe one day you put your fist through a window, right? Well, then you're living a life where you don't put your fist through a window anymore, and you need to find somebody putting a fist through a window someplace to get that energy. And that's where I think Violence, the representation of violence in film and in theater or in song or in literature, comes to be something that I really sink my arms into. And you go, you know, you start seeking out extreme iterations of it, like slasher movies, which I've seen, you know, most of. So.
Well, you know,
twice.
As you say, you grew up around Violence and, you know, it's been written about in your music. You've talked about it in interviews. I'm not spilling any beans here. I'm curious if that excitement, which can often turn into anxiety, because anxiety is a useful thing when you're in a violent home as a kid, because you need to be hyper aware in case something comes flying at your head, a fist or a plate or something.
Sure.
Did that anxiety stay with you into adulthood? Like, after the threat had passed, was it still something you had to address?
Well, I don't want to attribute the anxiety. I mean, like, that's literally my diagnosis. Okay. Like, such as it is, it's a minor anxiety diagnosis. But I don't attribute it to my upbringing. I think I'm wired that way. You know, I think I have a level of anxiety that comes with the package, and that for the most part is extremely useful to me. You know, that's the thing, is like, when you pursue calm as you do as an adult, often, you know, everybody at some point tries meditation or whatever, or, you know, explores some various relaxation techniques, and it feels so good and so great when you're able to get into it. But for me, in my work, in what I do, in the way, when we're having this conversation, there's a low-level anxiety that informs my ability to think on the fly, to answer a question at length and see where the question goes, that I don't think, minus that anxiety, I'd find the interesting places to go. I think I might just say, you know, well, I don't know. It's like, you know, it's like anxiety, you know, performance anxiety drives the desire to please you with a good answer, right? And if I give good interviews at all, that's in there. I think that most of the anxiety I have is just part of the way that God made me, right? And I think my, you know, mission has been to sort of learn to deploy it constructively, which for the most part in adulthood I've been able to do. I mean, the other thing, but I noticed this like at parties. I don't like to go to parties. I don't like to be around people, generally speaking, you know, even though if I go without being around people too long, it's very unhealthy. And so I sort of have to find some sort of balance, and like, don't always tell your friends you're busy. It's good to hang with your friends sometimes, you know. But if I find myself at a party, I'll start putting away the sauce, man. I do not drink one glass of wine. I finish that one with a hurry, right? Because, and it has taken me until my 50s to go, oh, you're nervous. You're very nervous here. And you're trying to power some drinks to sand down the nervousness. You know, that's what that's about. And I don't think I noticed that at like 49 or 50. It's like, oh, you really up it at the party. And I think when you're younger, you think, well, it's because the drinks are free at the party. Look, man, the drinks are free at my house now, so I don't need to go to the party for free booze, you know. But in point of fact, I totally, as soon as I get there, I go, oh, yeah, but now I take stock of it, you know, and I stand there and go, are you nervous? Well, none of these people are trying to hurt you. You'll be all right.
Well, it's probably why there are drinks at parties to some extent.
Oh, yeah.
That's probably why it's been put there.
Because those of us who are nervous around other people are right. It's very anxiety-producing to be around other people.
It's a sensible response. Well, I mean, that...
to people.
That, the threat. So then, the past couple of years during COVID, I'm sure you've played some shows, but severely curtailed. And that's a social setting to some extent. It's you talking and other people listening. But
That's not a social setting for me, though. It's a whole different thing.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm not having to stand near people when I'm on stage. If I choose to breach that barrier, then there's actually, you know, if I launch myself in the audience, the transgressive quality there really offsets any of the, you know, and it's so contained and limited, you know, and the risk of conversation is absent, right? It's a collaborative effort to make poetry, kind of, is what performance is. So yeah, so that's different from people asking you how you're doing.
Right. But you're still in the presence of others, and I wonder what effect...
Oh yeah, no, it's not being around their bodies. It's not the presence of others in a room that gets to me. It's the threat of conversation. Said the interview subject.
I feel the same way. Like if I'm on stage, I know what I'm going to say, and then everything is safe. But the mingle is what kills me.
No, I have a great story from. Have you been out to Sketchfest in San Francisco?
Yeah.
Sharpling, I think, had brought me out to play with Sharpling and Worcester on their live thing, and Hodgman was there. Everybody was there. Right. It's a whole big. It's a scene. Right. And we're staying at a hotel, and I think I did a thing at John's thing. That's right. Yes, I was on Judge John Hodgman also, I think. And we all take a cab back to the hotel, and John says, well, we're going to go. John's a very convivial, social guy. And he says, you know, we're going to go get drinks at the bar. Won't you join us? And I said, sure. Seemed like a harmless enough proposition from a friend in the cab, right? And we get to the hotel, and like half of Sketchfest is in the bar. Everybody. And these are all very charismatic people, right?
Yes.
And I excused myself to go up to my room and get my act together. And I didn't come back down for about half an hour. I said, hey, sorry, took me so long. I was kind of nervous to see other people. And John said, yeah, no, I could tell from the way that you immediately turned toward the elevator while saying too many people, too many people, too many people over and over again. And I was like, no, I didn't do that. He said, yes, you did.
Wow.
That's one of my favorite things I ever heard. Because I did not know that I had out loud said too many people, too many people,
right,
too many
right. people. Right. The anxiety powered you out of your own body. And
no, it was literally like, it's like, hey, I'm taking the wheel and we're going to the elevator. And the thing is, then I relaxed for half an hour. I came back down because I do think, and I think maybe I have some different thinking about this. I mean, I think I don't want people to accommodate me too much on these things because I think it's good for me to be a little, I know it's good for me to be a little social. I know it's good for me to be a little uncomfortable, right? It's not necessarily traumatizing, right? It maybe if I'm, you know, I can look at it that way, but I can also look at it as a growth opportunity. And that's what I choose to try and do. I try to say yes, right? Because I'm 55, right? I'm going to die at some point. And I don't want to say, well, you didn't go meet this guy who you would have really liked because you were afraid you'd feel awkward. You know, I could sit with awkwardness. That's cool. So I do try to overcome it to some extent.
Yeah. Well, then what has the last couple of years been like when a lot of those opportunities have been taken away?
Well, the first couple of months were bliss.
Yeah.
it's like me and John Worcester talked about it. It's like, this is not that different from how I normally live. But yeah, the fact that if I went out to lunch with my friend Sammy, you know, I love Sammy. I love to have lunch with Sammy. Well, we got a lunch outside early once, but we couldn't really sit down inside. And this is so hard to plan for those things. The spontaneity of like, you want to meet for lunch today, you know, that went away. And I value spontaneity. And I found that there are limits to how much I can benefit from isolating. Right? And there's a sweet spot. Like I need... It makes me think of like, you know, eccentric billionaire ideas like that. Like I think there's somewhere there is an absolute amount of socialization that is perfect for me. Right. Where if I see some people and have a good time, have a good, funny conversation, but I get out before I just start to this exhaustion sets in at some point, like my brain, I think, is firing at weird frequencies when I'm around a lot of people. And then it goes in this hyperdrive so I can talk all night, as you can probably tell listening to me right now. But then at the end, I just feel like, you know, a truck got driven through my skull. And so there's some sort of sweet spot that I sort of wish I could engineer. It's like, you know, where somebody would show up at 10:15 and go, John, you have your socialization appointment. It's 45 minutes and then I'll pick you up at the end of it. Right. So during COVID, I really did, you know, I started missing people and I miss performing because I say that's not socialization, but for me, it does satisfy the need to be around people, right? I don't have a need to be completely by myself. I have a weird relationship to being around people. Where, you know, if I'm not doing my thing, then I would prefer to be silent and not addressed, right? And then and I'm fine that way. That's great, you know. Yeah, for a while it seemed okay, and then it was like, oh, are you going to come back from this, or are you going to be worse than you were before?
Yeah, no, my friend John Ross Bowie said, you know, now, like when COVID first started, he's like, now all the other people know what is like for us anxious and depressed people. Like, we've been training for this our whole life, and now is our big moment.
Yeah, no, that's a great line.
I kind of felt the same way, but then I also found myself after a while, like, you know, even though I think of myself as wanting to stay home, I think if you're around people, you can, like, leech the nutrients off of them.
Yeah.
You can gather those.
Yeah, and I think, and the thing is also, I mean, I live in a house with a family, and me, I'm, like, less feeling the absence of it than other people who need it more, right? You know, it's just better for the world to work. The way that socialization generally works in the world is an accidental process of millions of years of evolution, right? Mm-hmm. It, like, it works for most people. It's good for most people to some extent, right? I think, I mean, it's very in vogue to ascribe everything to late capitalism now, but I do think that the capitalist societies we built have changed the nature of that in a way that makes some of it a lot harder to wrangle and harder for it to be productive. And I think being, you know, being out in a space where everything is targeted to sell you something changes the nature of being outside,
right?
You know, radically, intensely. It's like when everything, you know, having to walk past things you can't afford changes the nature of things of being outside in public. In your own house, you know that everything there is not going to ask anything extra of you, you know, whereas out in a world where money is the bottom line, everything is asking something of you to some extent. And these things are kind of, these play into, I think, how a lot of us were like, I'm at home. It's home is cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So, home is fine. But it did, I already think, own all these things.
Yeah. But I do also think, I think that, you know, as I say, I don't want to over accommodate the parts of myself, you know, that are unhealthily resistive to being around people. You know, it's like, I do think it's generally good for me to sort of find the edge there and walk that. You know, I think other people, I'm not speaking for anybody else, but for me, it's like when somebody invites me out, like I say, try to say yes. And COVID stomped on that pretty hard. It's like, I talk about Hodgman, it's like seeing Hodgman once a year, that fills up a part of me. I'm very fond of him, right? And our friendship is in this space that no one else can satisfy, right? It's like a lunch with John gives me something that I need, right? And I don't think of myself as needing that. I don't sit around going, okay, you need a lunch with Hodgman and something. My socialization guy hasn't told me to go do the Hodgman. But I get it on tour. By going out on tour, I'll be in New York and John will say, hey, are you around? Do you want to get lunch? And I will say, oh, I got a very busy, yes, let me do that. And so, and then I'll do it and that will fill my vessel, you know, to some extent, you know, and well, being off tour for 2 years, all of those opportunities went away, right? And John's just an example, right? I have a number of friends who it's good for me to go see. It's good for me to have lunch with Barry Sanders. Good for me to see my friend Steve Arkonovich in Portland. You know, it's good for me to see these people, you know, to make room in my day to feel whole, you know, and COVID shut that down.
Did you just say Barry Sanders, like the Detroit Lions running back?
No, Barry Sanders, the professor to whom Devil House is dedicated.
Oh, okay.
He, the guy who taught me Chaucer.
Oh, okay. That's much
also
more
also probably a running back of some of considerable prowess, but he's 90 or so. So I think probably he's generally QB and a little more needs to stay safer in the pocket.
On the subject of Hodgman, and this is a perfect segue because we're airing this episode during our Max Fun Drive. This is when
you got to donate to Maximum Fun, people. You got to donate. You got to show up with your wallet in your hand. If you happen to have a cool Velcro Hellraiser wallet like me, then, you know, more power to you. But you got to get out your credit card.
And for this particular Max Fun Drive, we have a bonus episode for donors, which is an episode called Sleeping with Celebrities, where some of the people we have on the show.
We literally allow you to sleep with a celebrity.
We've raised so much money from it. No.
It's deeply degrading. It's kind of Roman.
Yeah. It's illegal. It's don't tell anyone. No, it's where some of our guests tell the most boring stories or most boring information they possibly can in low, dulcet public radio tones,
right,
as part of an effort to put you to sleep. So we asked John to come on and talk for 10 minutes on one of these. We got him on. And I said, so do you have something to talk about for 10 minutes? And he said, oh, we're going to go way longer than that. And so for an hour, he played SimCity 5 and narrated what he was doing for an hour. And it was honestly, it was funny and it was transgressive, but it was also so soothing.
Oh, my God.
Hi, John Moe again. We'll get back to my interview with John Darnielle in just a minute. Well, so I already spilled the beans on this year's bonus content from Depression Mode for our annual Max Fun Drive. I already mentioned it there in that interview. When you donate, even at the $5 per month level, you get two things. One, the satisfaction of knowing that you make Depression Mode possible. You make it happen. You are helping people in the world. And you get access to Sleeping with Celebrities. It's a massive piece of tactical audio designed to help you sleep. It's an episode of the show, but it's really a tool. You play it on your phone next to your bed, on a smart speaker, maybe on wraparound headphones if you're sleeping with another person. And you hear me talking with famous people, guests from our show, other podcast hosts, about the most boring stuff imaginable. Stuff they know a lot about, but is definitely not interesting. That is the challenge I put forward to our friends, and boy, did they deliver. In these conversations, there are no shocks, no epiphanies, no twists, no one raises their voice, there are no cliffhangers. We have John Hodgman talking about and playing SimCity 5. Peter Sagal from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me talks about his preferred socks for running. Janet Varney from the JV Club podcast on a road trip from Tucson to Montana that she took as a kid. From Maximum Fun's Fanti podcast, we have Jarrett Hill and Travell Anderson talking about glasses sliding down your nose, but then the conversation gently pivots to talking about how to cook rice. Sleeping with Celebrities is over 3.5 hours long. We have so many different guests, Jesse Thorne and Jordan Morris from Jordan Jesse Go. We have so many people on this show. It's a delight. We hope you never hear the end of Sleeping with Celebrities because you're sleeping. If you do reach the end of it, that's fine. Just let it loop. Gabe Mara, our producer, says you can even listen while awake because in his mind, it's perfect anti-comedy. Just a long setup for a punchline that will never, ever, ever arrive. Sleeping with Celebrities is so fun. We had a great time making it. We think you'll really enjoy it and hopefully doze off. Now, at $10 a month or higher, you get Sleeping with Celebrities and you can choose a patch, an embroidered patch. Just like in the old days, just like in the 70s, you can sew or iron it onto your, I don't know, your JanSport backpack, your fanny pack, your denim vest with the sleeves cut off. 35 patches to choose from, including the official Depression Mode patch. And our patch features Oops Nope. Now, if you're on the Preshies Facebook group, you know about Oops Nope. Oops Nope is the mascot of Depression Mode. Oops Nope is a fish. It's a type of fish called an Oopu Nopili, and we kind of turn that into Oops Nope as a name. The Oopu Nopili is a waterfall climbing fish. It's this little fish. It's kind of rare. And what it does throughout its life, it climbs up the side of a waterfall, just sucking onto the walls of it, just little micro inch by micro inch. And the people at Just the Zoo of Us, which is Maximum Fun's animal podcast, thought it would be a perfect symbol for our show. We agree. So Oops Nope is on our patch, and Oops Nope is wearing a little tiny pair of sweatpants. So you get that at the $10 a month level. You get Sleeping with Celebrities and the patch and a Max Fun membership card. And those are all fun. Maximum fun, as it were. But honestly, what you're donating to here is the idea of the show. As I said, being a human is hard. Operating and maintaining a human mind is hard as hell sometimes, you guys. I think if we work together, it's a little easier. I started talking about mental health because I decided the best thing I could do as a person is to help other people carry their loads. Will you join me in that effort? Will you let me help carry your load? Will you help carry the loads of others? Do you feel that your load has been carried in some way by the show that you've been listening to? Here's what you do. You go to MaximumFun.org /join. Select Depression Mode and find a level that works for you. And then reap the benefits, reap the satisfaction of supporting the show, and you get to enjoy sleeping with celebrities, the Oops Note patch, other gifts available, so much there. MaximumFun.org/join. Okay, back to our interview with John Darnielle. Back with John Darnielle. As I mentioned earlier, John had some problems going when he was younger. Abusive stepfather, substance use disorder, and he uses that. He is an artist. He's a writer. He draws from a personal well. Back to Devil House and back to your books and your music. I finished Devil House, and then in my notes, I wrote down the phrase youth in distress, because I had thought about the plot of Devil House, and then I thought about all your music, and it's a theme, and your other books, and youth in psychological distress comes up a lot. Do you agree that that's a theme of your work? And if so, why do you think it's there?
Well, John, as Skid Row said, we live our lives on trial. We walk an endless mile. We are the youth gone wild. And the thing with Devil House, you were talking about revelations, is like, well, there's some young people in Devil House who are maybe less young than they seem to be. But I think I was pretty affected as a writer by a quote attributed to Kurt Vonnegut. And this is when I was young, I read this. And sometimes you'd run across, I think I went through a phase of really liking quotations. I had a Bartlett's Familiar Quotations. I was looking for good quotes, you know, and I think there was a phase. A lot of motivational speaker guys, that's their whole lookout, is find the good quotes, right? These days, I like longer extracts. I like to dig a little deeper. But Kurt Vonnegut was said to have said, I've never sourced it, high school is about as close to the core of the American experience as you can get, right? And it made a big impression on me at the time because I was in high school, right? And of course, when you're in high school, you absolutely feel that. You feel that you are at the center of every experience, right? You're sort of the centrality of your life seems so vivid to you. And as you're sort of beginning to feel present to it as an independent actor, you know, in a way that you don't have as a child. So, my adolescence for also because it was a turbulent time left a big effect on me. And it's when you're learning about stuff, you know, and when you're first learning about stuff, it has a fresh fire to it, you know, like a 16-year-old who finds out that the Velvet Underground is good, as I did, will tell people who have known for a decade, you got to hear White Light, White Heat. This record is incredible. And you might go, oh yeah, no, I actually bought it when it was new. Okay, well, then tell me which is your favorite song. Well, I don't know, I haven't listened to it in a while. You haven't listened to it in a while? What is wrong with you? This is a masterpiece, right? That was me in high school, right? So I think the intensity of the experience, you know, of adolescence, of sort of beginning to sense that there will be a place that you will occupy in the world if you are around for that, you know, the sense that you're starting to be able to pose bigger questions than you would have been able to pose. These are all pretty heady moments in a person's life. And I think they, because you don't yet have the tools to parse them, that sort of moment of incomprehension lingers a long time, it feels like to me. I mean, I think you see this on Facebook, if you're in your 50s, your friends, a lot of people in their 50s, people have a strong relationship, Americans, I want to say particularly, to their youth. They think about it in a certain way. They contextualize in a certain way. I'm interested in that, in part because I think it's kind of a weird legacy of romanticism. And in, like, my life today at 55 is every bit as vital as it was when it was 17. It's actually considerably more complex because when you have traveled a bunch of road, then there is a greater complexity to almost every thought you have, right? There's more weight on it. You know, there's more, you can understand your impulses a little better in a lot of ways. But you do, you have to get that, you have to trade the rawness of the experience, the immediacy of everything being new. Even though when you're 17, if somebody says to you, like, well, you know, everything's new to you right now, you go, ah, fuck you. Do you speak to me like that? You know, like, no, I've been around a little bit. And you have, but there's something in the way we think about youth that I think is present for most people a lot of the time, right? And then there's another big thing with me, which is the fact that people don't attribute agency to young people in a way that they deserve. And that's been a lookout of mine since I worked with children and adolescents as a nurse, right? Big thing for me.
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask about that too, because I think it matters for someone listening to your music, reading your books, that your youth, we mentioned briefly abuse in your home, but the time that you spent kind of messed up on drugs in Portland, you were living on the streets.
In California, too.
In California. Yeah, you were fully coastal with your drug abuse as a young person.
Oh, yes. Never got across the border into Vancouver, Washington to take drugs there.
It's a hell of a river to cross. Why were you, this is a reductive question on purpose. Why were you doing something like methamphetamine when you knew that it was bad for you?
Man, my answers for this are not good. It's like they're not... Because they're not good for addicts to hear. They're not, but I have to be real. It's like, I know that there are psychological explanations for why a perfectly intelligent kid is taking drugs that can really severely harm him, right? But the only answer I can give as the addict who was taking them is because it felt amazing, right? It's like solve for amazing there. How does it feel? Takes you out of yourself. You no longer think at all about the consequence of your action. I do also think in the case of meth specifically, it helps wear away the part of you. Meth is really bad on your moral center, right? And I have one. And when you are living in the home I was living in high school, you start to wish you didn't. And this is a pretty complex process. But for me, I found myself sort of wanting to be a real piece of shit, right? I wanted to get to a point where I didn't care, booze is good for this. But meth is without peer for this. It's like, you just don't, if you're shooting meth, which is what I did, the second it hits, you don't care. You do not care, right? Lou Reed has the famous line of heroin. Is, I guess that when the smack begins to flow, then I really don't care anymore. But that's kind of true, but I've done a lot of heroin. You care, but just at a slower pace, you know? But meth really just, it seems to absolutely zero in on the parts of you that are noble and good and say, you don't need those, right? You don't need any of that, right? You don't feel guilt anymore. You don't have those problems. Cocaine, I think, is really the same way. It's just not as caustic and immediate about it.
Well, and I mean, I've told you before that the songs on We Shall All Be Healed meant a lot to me, particularly the ones that involved the nation of Belgium. And
yes.
And there is a lot of internal logic. Like, the characters in those songs are justifying what happens, and they're reasoning out what happens. And, you know, if you squint, you can kind of keep up with their reasoning. But there's an internal logic to all of it, even as they're trying to kind of leave the world behind.
Yeah, no, there's that's another thing I think about the territory of when you're, if you're in a period of addiction and everything, is it tends to get reduced as if it were a sort of two-dimensional space, but it's actually really complex. I mean, that's what's very hard to reproduce about it when you're writing about it, it's hard to explain it's hard to explain any experience from the outside, but particularly when it involves a lot of experiences that other people haven't had, right? So when you talk about staying up all night shooting meth, you exclude 99% of the population from really being able to say, oh, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. They don't know, right? And to make them know, well, you don't want them really to know. And so then you think, well, what's another thing that people can't understand? A country they haven't been to. Right, a place that they know something about, they know its name, they've heard about it, they could identify stuff that's from there, right? But they can't go there, they can't have been there. I think that's where that intersects.
That's where Belgium comes in. Another reductive question, I guess: why did you stop doing these drugs?
The way I always talk about it for me is, well, no, you know what? There's a romantic way of talking about it, and there's the actual truth, which is that I had a prison sentence hanging over my head, and I was sent on a court card to mandatory AA and NA meetings, right? I don't think, in the absence of that, that I probably would have stayed sober for 5 years, which I did. I now drink wine, and, it's inconceivable of me to do hard drugs. I just can't. I'm a 55-year-old father of two, right? This sort of tells you that whatever my relationship to drugs is, its avenue isn't the one where... I was talking about this actually to an interviewer yesterday. It's like, I got a colonoscopy and they give you fentanyl, right? And for 2 seconds or 5 seconds, you get that opiate rush. Now, to me, that is a rush that I sought out on a daily basis for the better part of a year when I was a teenager, right? Not at the level of prescription-grade fentanyl, right? But if I could have, obviously, yes, but no. Well, you know, when I got that, right, before I went under, I was like, oh my God, there it is, most amazing feeling, right? But that doesn't for me at all translate into, I have to go find me some dope now, right? In my 20s, absolutely, I would have gone, oh, you know what I miss is that. At some point, I crossed a bridge, and I think 5 years of sobriety was what did it for me. That, like, when I came back from that, and I did, there's a line in AA, and I'm always want to couch this in, like, I'm not recommending my path to anybody, right? I would say, if you think you have a problem with addiction, get sober and stay sober, right? Don't be like me, you know. For me, as it happens, there's a line in the Big Book, or I think it's in the 12 Traditions. If any of us can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried long enough and hard enough to do it. When I won't say that I haven't gotten drunk and embarrassed myself multiple times over the past 30 years since I went to see whether I could do it or not, but I can say that I haven't driven drunk. I can say that I haven't, you know, that I haven't run into the losses that addicts usually run into. So that's where I landed with that. But as far as stopping using the hard drugs, I had a court sentence hanging over me, a prison sentence, right? And for drug paraphernalia, and they never found the actual drugs, and neither did I. And this is what was messed up about it. It was like they got my car and they found the crack pipe, but there was crack in the car and they didn't find that. Or the sentence would have been, but neither did I. And I was looking for it after I got out of jail. I was like, well, it's in here somewhere because they didn't charge me with it. But I really didn't want to go back to jail. Jail is bad. I had been twice in the space of a month and I could sense that my luck had run out, right? That there was just more of this down that road for me, right? So for me, it was extremely important and I stayed absolutely, I walked straight and narrow for 5 years.
Coming up, John Darnielle, 55-year-old musician, becomes a viral video teen sensation, which is weird. All right, I mentioned songs about Belgium in that last segment, and I didn't really explain it, so I'll explain it now. Two songs by the Mountain Goats, Letter from Belgium and Your Belgian Things, off the 2004 album We Shall All Be Healed. The first, Letter from Belgium, deals with the experience of being high on methamphetamine and the way the mind operates inside of that space. The second song, Your Belgian Things, is about trying to clean up the wreckage of that drug. But Jesus, what a mess, John sings. My attachment to these songs is very hard for me to talk about. I think I gotta, though. My older brother, Rick, who was my hero when I was a kid, who taught me to drive, developed a substance use disorder, and he did a lot of methamphetamine. And later, many years later, he sought sobriety, and he dealt with the wreckage. He also had major depressive disorder, and he died by suicide in 2007. In these songs about Belgium that John Darnielle has, Belgium, as he explained, is a metaphor for something that is impossibly foreign. And these songs, especially after Rick died, let me kind of see mental photographs of who Rick may have been during the times that there were no records of him. And so these songs are important to me. My goal, and it is unattainable, but yet it is there and it is my goal, is to have nobody feel alone in their pain that stems from mental health problems, to have zero people think that there's no way out. So that's why I started talking about it into microphones and writing about it and asking for stories from other people and telling those stories and getting those people to talk into microphones and getting all of that put into podcast feeds. That's why I do it. It's the best use of my time, skills, and resources, and I know it makes a difference. I hear from people all the time. I've been hearing from listeners for years that it makes a difference, that it helps. It's too late for Rick. It's not too late for someone else. Will you help me? Will you donate to Depression Mode? Will you help allow Depression Mode to exist to get stronger, to get louder, to help more people. I will now lighten the tone. When you join at only the $5 a month level, you get access to our audio insomnia treatment, our special called Sleeping with Celebrities. Over 3.5 hours of beloved personalities talking about the most boring stuff imaginable with the intention of you dozing off when you listen to it. We have Bridger Weinegar on there. We've got Laura House, who does our meditation segment on this show. She's on there. We had all sorts of people who agreed to do it and kind of got the bit that we were going for. It's really quite wonderful. When you give $10 a month, you get Sleeping with Celebrities plus a patch. You can choose the Oops Nope patch, our waterfall climbing fish. I designed this one, by the way. A real artist kind of cleaned it up, but we worked together. You get the Max Fun membership card. All that is at the $10 a month level. And the gifts just keep piling up. At higher levels, there are activity packs, messenger bags, hats. Check it all out at MaximumFun.org/join. Thank you for listening. Thank you for helping change the world. We're going back to the interview now. We're going to talk about TikTok. Back with John Darnielle, we've been talking about young people, and that path recently took an unexpected twist. The Mountain Goats' 2002 song, No Children, is about a miserably married couple who wish nothing but suffering for one another and themselves. Young folks on TikTok came up with a dance for it, and it became a viral video fad. They usually start the dance at around the 151 mark in the song. I am drowning. There was even another viral video fad with the Mountain Goats song called This Year. I was in my kitchen listening to some Mountain Goats music, and my 13...
Good stuff.
Good stuff. My 13-year-old daughter comes in the room, and she says, "How do you know this band?" And you know where I'm going with this.
God bless the youth of the world for that outlook.
I said, I've known this band longer than I've known you. And she says, you know, and then she talked about the TikTok phenomenon of people acting out very short segments of No Children and This Year. And you went viral on TikTok among the very young who were lip syncing your words. And what was that like for you?
Well, there's a couple things in here. I mean, one, it was a wild time because I don't use TikTok myself. There is a Mountain Goats TikTok, but it's adminned by my manager. I sort of feel like, as with Vine, it's like, that's just not my lookout. And so, you know, you sense I'm pretty good at Twitter most of the time. So I do Twitter, you know, but I'm not one of those guys who like, oh, there's a new one. I have to be on that too. That's not my style, you know. I have an Instagram, but I barely ever post on it. There's a Mountain Goats one. Manager does that. So I feel like, and I think it's, you know, when young people are doing something like TikTok and it's being cool, you just know that all the big actors are going, wait till I swoop in and I can really monetize the hell out of this. And it's so sad, you know, it's like, because some of us remember when the internet looked like it was going to be amazing and cool, right? It's like going to be this awesome space where all this cool stuff happened. And that wasn't what it was about, you know? But so I've tried to limit my engagement. I want to see funny TikToks if they pop up in my feed, you know, then it's funny to see. But I also sort of feel like I'm forever saying that I'm 55 these days because I love being 55 because I'm here and I feel good. I'm in good health and it rules. But yeah, so I limit my engagement with it because I feel that that's sort of the polite thing to do for a person of my age to say, well, I know what it is. I shouldn't be ignorant, you know, but I should let the kids play. Let them do what they want to do over there. And if they do something that rises to the level of your attention, applaud it, you know. But yeah, so people keep tagging me, hey, are you aware that this is going on? I'm like, you know, I'm not going to over-engage. If it's about me, I especially don't want to over-engage because I think we live in a time of severe navel-gazing and I don't want to be overthinking about the Mountain Goats or John Darnielle. I would much rather talk about other people's stuff, generally speaking, you know. So I really don't. If people are doing stuff with my stuff, God bless them. Have a good time. And it just kept getting bigger and bigger. The tags on Twitter are like stacking up to 10 and 20 a day. This is back in the fall. It's like, hey, you're a phenomenon. Really? Okay. And then we started getting requests for interviews about it from Variety, right? It's like, would John like to talk about being a TikTok phenomenon? It's like, oh my God. So I mean, they were like, you know, will you do this on TV? Will you do the dance on TV? Was a question on my plate at one point. No, I will not. It's not my place to do the dance. That's like very Steve Buscemi with the skateboard showing up. It's like, oh, now I'm doing it too. Wow. It's like, that seems so, you know, it's no. But yeah, so it was really something. And at the same time, it's one of those things where I could sense like this is an audience engaging your stuff and doing their own creative endeavor with it. To join in too loudly on that, to be too present for too much of it, is a degree of self-regard that I try to resist. Now, I'm being interviewed right now, so obviously I'm talking about myself a lot. This is the right place for me to be thinking and talking about myself a lot. Like, if I can't be in therapy, right, then I can do this, right? But I don't want to be out there constantly otherwise going, what's up with the popularity of No Children today? Right? I don't want to be tracking the trend or watching too many of those videos or anything. I just feel like it'd be gauche, you know? I'm sort of an outlier in that way of thinking about it. So yeah, so I noticed it and it was exciting that like suddenly, we knew from our spins on streaming, it's like suddenly, No Children went up by like 10 million plays. It's just bonkers, you know? Just bonkers. You could feel the power of, it's like really, we talked about the power of being young earlier. It's like, this was all young people. It was like a bunch of 15, 16-year-olds going, you know what I want to hear is this song from 2002.
Yeah, about desperately unhappy married people.
Yes.
Well, I got to think, though, that it's flattering, of course, and it's nice that your art is reaching people. But the idea that these people are lip-syncing to you, that people are standing in as you, saying, I am representing John Darnielle, and it's got to make you feel good about the durability of the artisanally crafted tool that you created for people.
Well, to some extent, I have a shtick about this. I use the word shtick. This Barry Sanders used to describe his pieces when he had an idea that he already has an idea about something, right? And my shtick is this, is like, I do feel great about, I wrote a song that's useful, right? It's got enough craft to it that, you know, a decade plus later, some people find it and go, oh, I could do something cool with this, right? But I don't think it makes me a genius or even particularly special, you know? It means that my craft rose to a level of, to a utilitarian level, right? And I am proud of that. I'm really proud of that. I think that speaks very well of my craft, right? I don't think it makes my thing even particularly special. I think what's special is when people notice, they find the zone in something, they locate that zone. Oh, here's the thing that this piece of work does that's sort of polyvalent. It's really productive of a bunch of other possible dance looks or whatever, right? But that speaks, and this is going to sound so corny, but it's true. It speaks so much more to the creativity of the people doing it than it does to some inherent great value in the original work. The original work, I'm not diminishing its value. I think I'm placing it in its proper context, right? The original work is good. I hope it's a little better than good. I think it's real good, right? But the fact that millions of TikTok teens find a thing to do with it speaks to their creativity more than it speaks to what's special about the song. Absolutely, I think that's true. You know, just as when, you know, in the golden age of sampling, people would be sampling some bit from, what's the piece that the Ghetto Boys sample for Damn It Feels Good to Be a Gangsta or for Mind Playing Tricks on Me? These are brief little samples, right? From great songs, right? I can't name them what they are, but they're great, you know, 70s soul tunes, right? Killer tunes. But the use of the sample, right, doesn't speak only to the goodness of the tune, but to the creativity of the producer working it. A great sample in the hands of a lesser producer makes a lesser track. And in the hands of the Bomb Squad, right, then it makes a nation of millions, right? So yeah, and I think it's the same thing. It's like, I think I wrote a good song. I'm proud of my song. I think that moment is so much more about the creativity of young people on TikTok finding a medium that's fairly new and playing with it, right? And that is what's worth remarking on in that moment, much more than my song.
Hung Up on My Baby by Isaac Hayes was what the Ghetto Boys sampled.
Ah, excellent. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I didn't know it offhand.
I wonder where he tracked that.
I looked that up. I mean, again, we're running this show during our fund drive, and I have
to... You got to get out the credit card. You got to give to maximum fun, because otherwise you'll be having less fun. And the important thing you want in this life is more fun. In fact, you want to spread joy up to the maximum. As God, who was it? Hoagy Carmichael? It's not Hoagy. I should know who wrote "Accentuate the Positive," but I don't off the top of my head. Please help me learn this by donating to Maximum Fun today. MaximumFun.org.
Reach out and touch us with your credit card.
That's right.
And I have to thank you in the context of this show, because I mean, I've been doing shows like this for a number of years, and I would get letters from people saying, "Your show saved my life. If it wasn't for your show, I wouldn't be here." And that was just too much for me to handle, because I thought, well, what if I do a show that sucks? You know, like, what?
Well, some of my shtick comes from that too, because I always want to tell people that, and I really believe it's true, because we all, most of us who are into music, have a song that we feel like, you know, that was the song that's, there's a saying in the evangelical, standing in the gap. Uh-huh. When you're praying for somebody, you're standing in the gap for them, right? Well, songs stand in the gap for us, or books, or movies, or whatever, you know, but songs especially sometimes, in your hour of darkness, you have a song that stands in the gap for you, right? But that's not, that songwriter did not save your life.
This is what you explained to me, but please continue.
Yeah, no, that's the thing, is that the song, you took it and did something with it. You used it, right? And the songwriter absolutely can feel tickled. It speaks to the craft of the song that a person who needs a song to stand in the gap for them is able to place it there for them. But the songwriter wrote it ages ago and was thinking about something else at the time. You know, it's the person. I mean, that is how you can use these things that help us to help us understand our own strength and power. You know, it's like when a song saved your life, you did that.
And you might not have realized that because of the where you were in your head.
Yeah. But when you get out of it, I think it's really important to understand the song is not what did it. You're the one who put the song there to do it, right? You're the one. And this is why this helps you understand, actually, like rock people in the anti-disco age and stuff would diminish the position of the DJ. To be a DJ is to do an incredible thing, right? Is to say, this crowd needs to hear this song right now. Watch what happens when I play this song. A real DJ doing that on the fly, right, can absolutely shape a mood with greater certainty than any chemist can take an evening to places. And then there's the element of accident where the DJ also can't be sure exactly where it's going to go. It's just miraculous where it becomes collaborative there. But yeah, so I mean, that's my shtick about that. It's like, you know, the song didn't save your life. You used the song to save your own life. And I mean, again, it sounds kind of quaint, but it's totally... People have to understand that that is the truth, right?
Yeah. You built the raft that prevented your drowning.
Yeah. And God bless the guy who made the raft. You need a raft, right? You got to have that raft. You can't just make one up when the moment comes.
Right.
You may or may not have the materials, but you're the one who blew the air into it, right? So.
John Darnielle, congratulations on Devil House, and thank you so much.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to talk with you. It's good to be here.
That's John Darnielle. The new book is Devil House. Music by the Mountain Goats is available at all music services, where you can also hear the bands he mentioned, Morbid Angel, Ripping Corpse, and Hate Eternal. Those sound like especially ghoulish racehorses to me. Thank you for taking this journey with me today. We got a little more in-depth. We got a little more emotional, even than we often do, which is pretty emotional to begin with. So thanks for being with us. We need your help if we're going to keep making Depression Mode and keep trying to help people. We want new members. If you're already a member, please consider boosting your membership, raising the level a little bit to help us even more. If we reach 500 new or boosting members, I will do this. I will make a video where I attempt to interview puppies about mental health. So we get puppies, we get a mental health discussion. I'm not sure how good the puppies are going to be at answering the questions, but I think we'll all enjoy it. MaximumFun.org/join. Next time on Depression Mode, S.E. Cupp has done a whole lot of political analysis on cable news over the years. Then she had a bit of an emotional wipeout a while back, and now she has some good insight on social media usage.
I go on intentionally, And if it's a work day and I know I'm going to have to see some tough videos, at least I can mentally prepare and it's not going to happen to me when I'm least expecting it. I can also decide, well, I'm not going on right now because I don't need anything from Twitter. And maybe I can get that validation from somewhere else, from my family, you know? Maybe I can clear my brain from the news by taking a walk. Maybe I can get whatever I thought I needed from social media in a healthier place. So thinking differently about how I use social media was, in a way, very simple, but so life-altering.
Be sure to hit subscribe on Depresh Mode. Give us 5 stars. Write reviews. Please know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free. 1-800-273-8255. That's 800-273-TALK. The crisis text line is free and always available. Text HOME to 741-741. Please use our electric mail address, depreshmode@maximumfun.org. We'd love to hear from you. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. Our Depresh Mode newsletter is on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter at John Moe. High credits, listeners. I am spent. Depresh Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings. Special thanks to Laura Swisher.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Christine Rombaletti, Reston, Virginia. Be kind to yourself. Every day is part of the journey.
Depresh Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.